Welcome to the Thrive Podcast with the Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church.
How does your faith kind of play into it, or does it play into it?
What can be done about it?
When I say the church, I'm talking about evangelical white Christians and the black folk who attend their churches.
Hello. Welcome to the Thrive Podcast with the Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church. I'm Fred Jeff Smith, pastor of Shiloh, and I'm very happy that you're either viewing this on YouTube or Facebook, or you're listening to us on iTunes, Spotify, or Amazon Prime. Please let us know how we're doing. You can reach me at fredjeffsmith@gmail.com. There's a difference. It used to be Cox, but it's now fredjeffsmith@gmail.com. Please feel free to reach out to us and tell us how we are doing. I'm very happy to welcome back to the Thrive Podcast Mr. Luke Mixon, who is a candidate for United States Senate, running against Senator John Kennedy, among others. Mr. Mixon, thank you for taking the time to come back and share with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
How you feeling?
I'm feeling great. We're busy, but I'm feeling great. We're traveling the state. We're meeting lots of voters and really enjoying listening to concerns of Louisiana residents. And we're having a blast. I think we have, if I'm not mistaken, 75 more days.
And
if I'm not mistaken, I think it's what we have left. And I'm really excited.
So the last time you were here, we said that we had hoped that you would come back before the election. And we're grateful that you have. Do you feel better about your position now than you did the first time that you were here? Not necessarily against your Democratic opponents, mm-hmm. but against the incumbent.
Well, I've always felt that we were doing the right thing, and I've always been very enthusiastic about our campaign. Mm-hmm. And I always had a lot of confidence in both my abilities and the ability of this team we have. But to answer your question, I am more enthusiastic now. We've really got a great team together, a diverse team, young, old, experienced people, and I'm really excited about the support we've gotten lately. As you know, I think since last time we spoke, we've gotten, I won't go through the whole list, we've gotten endorsements from the governor, mm-hmm. From Representative Randall Gaines, Representative Kenny Cox, several mayors throughout the state. We've gotten the endorsement of the AFL-CIO, Alliance for Good Government, Louisiana Democratic Party. So we've really come a long way. Our fundraising, I think it is growing exponentially every quarter. So I'm really excited. Really excited.
Well, you brought up endorsements, so that'll be the first thing that I ask you about. The news recently had an article in it about the Democratic Party endorsement that a committee had voted to endorse one of your opponents, and somehow or other that was overruled, and instead what the party did was do a triple endorsement mm-hmm. for all three Democratic candidates. From your perspective, were you satisfied with how that whole process went?
Yeah, I'll just start by saying it was a tremendous honor and privilege to receive an endorsement from Democratic Party. I realize it was a tri-endorsement, I hope that's the right word, with me and the other two candidates. But I was so honored to receive that. You are correct. There was a recommendation from the, I guess it's called the Executive Committee, mm-hmm. and the body as a whole voted to overrule that. And by a 2-1 margin, they voted to endorse all three candidates. And, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think the three of us all bring different perspectives. I think some of us represent more of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Maybe some of us represent, and myself, more of the moderate wing of the Democratic, more in the John Bel Edwards mold. And I really felt that, well, I didn't feel, by a 2-1 margin, the body of the Democratic Party agreed with that. But again, it was just a real privilege. You know, I talk a lot about my grandmother, and I thought about her a lot that day. My grandmother is a lifelong Democrat, and her whole wall at her house was filled with her and pictures with John Brough and Joe Biden. And she was a delegate on the 1992 convention for President Bill Clinton. And unfortunately, she passed away in June, but all I could think about is how proud she would have been of me
sure.
To receive that endorsement. So it was a really wonderful day to me, and I couldn't be prouder.
You have had the opportunity, I've seen snippets on social media and on the news, you've had opportunities to have debates with your fellow candidates. How do you think that process has gone? When you have debates like this, I would imagine we've sponsored a couple of debates for different campaigns here. I would imagine that there is a point in this where it's not just about scoring points against the other person, but the give and take, where you all have the opportunity to learn from one another. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you have learned from that process, and do you think that your opponents have learned also? I'm just curious about your thoughts about the whole process.
Look, absolutely. I have a I always say, you know, we're all a work in progress. And if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And I've really had the privilege of learning from the other candidates in the race. They bring to the table experiences that maybe I haven't had. You know, they we all have advocated and fought for our communities and our country in different ways. Obviously, most of my experience is in the military, and I'm proud of the service I had. And the other candidates do that. They have more experience in local government here in Baton Rouge, and the other candidate in Miss Dive in New Orleans. I think they've learned from me. I know I learn a lot from them. But the truth of the matter is, who I haven't learned very much from is Senator Kennedy. And that's what my focus is on. My focus on defeating Senator John Kennedy. I believe he continues – believe is the wrong word. I know he continues to represent our state and our nation very poorly. And everywhere I go, I'm reminded of that.
From a dollars standpoint, I understand that Mr. Kennedy has a huge swath of dollars at his disposal for his campaign. Dollars don't necessarily translate into votes, but it helps to get the message out and across. How are you prepared to combat the overwhelming cash flow that Senator Kennedy has in order to make sure that your message reaches as many people as you want it to reach?
Well, you know, I'll obviously give you the very cliche answer of hard work, and that's true. But it's also true that you do need the resources to run a serious campaign. And I say all the time, I think we have a good message. It resonates with people. I believe I deliver that message very well. But you need the resource to ensure that 4 million people in the state of Louisiana hear that message. And we are working very hard on raising money to do that. And I've been very proud of our fundraising efforts. We are the highest. We have the most. In fact, if you, as of July 1st, yeah, there are 13 candidates in the race, obviously Mr. Kennedy, myself, and then 11 others. And on July 1st, if you took all of the cash on hand of the 11 other candidates, we quadrupled that. We had four times the amount of cash on hand as the other candidates combined, with the exception of Mr. Kennedy.
Of course.
So I believe that we are the only candidate that has the resources in order to get our message out in order to be competitive in this race.
What makes John Kennedy tick? From your perspective, this folksy, down-home, homespun attitude that he likes to put forth, the twang in his voice, and always coming up with the right parable to try to get his point across, it's fake. I know it's fake. You know it's fake. Everybody knows it's fake. And yet he continues to embrace it and promote it. And for whatever reason, there's enough Louisiana voters that seem persuaded by that. What do you think it is about that makes it work for him?
Well, I guess I can't answer that question very well because I don't associate with that. And I don't know how someone could behave that way. I'll say this. I speak to people all the time who have known him for 30, 40 years. And the one consistent message I hear from those people is they'll always say, something changed. Luke, something changed when he got to Washington. He never acted this way. And they continue to be surprised by the way he votes. You know, I can just recently, he voted against the CHIPS bill, which incentivizes the manufacturing of semiconductors here in the United States, although he claims to be America first. As he mentioned, he voted against the infrastructure bill, which Bill Cassidy is touring the state right now, and everyone is singing his praises for bringing those resources right. that we so desperately need. He voted against responsible gun legislation. Again, a bipartisan effort to make our schools safer, to keep our kids free from gun violence. And as you all know, he voted to overturn our election on January 6th, which is really the hallmark of my campaign and what is, I'm passionate about. As for an explanation, I don't have a great answer for you other than I suspect he's lost his way. And I suspect he has forgotten that it's not about him. Mm-hmm. It should be a public service. Mm-hmm. It's not about some selfish political ambition. It's about serving those you represent. And that's what I'm all about. My entire life has been spent in service to our nation. I believe I have more to offer. I believe I could represent our state better than him.
Let's turn our attention to Ukraine for a second. Mm-hmm. I looked it up just before we started. At this point, the United States has committed $13.5 billion to the support of Ukraine, going back to 21 and through the most recent appropriation that the president has put forth for Ukraine. Do you agree with the Ukraine war effort and the way that the money is being spent? As a senator, that would certainly fall within your purview. So are you approving of what you see going on with the Ukraine war effort and the dollars that are being spent?
I am. I do. I believe that we should continue to provide them the resources they need to defend themselves. You know, I they are fighting for their country. They're fighting for their women and children, fighting for their freedoms, all the things that we as Americans value. And I believe their Western values reflect ours. And I believe that we have a responsibility to provide them the resources they need. And look, I believe President Joe Biden has done a wonderful job at uniting NATO behind Ukraine. And it's important that we protect them from what is a murderous tyrant in the form of President Vladimir Putin. He has proven over and over again to be a vicious murderer of women and children, and we must stand up against him.
Why do you think spending coming from other European allies has been so sparse in comparison to spending coming from the United States? I saw something the other day that said that after the United States, the next largest contributor is Germany, and it's like $2 billion as opposed to $13.5 billion. That's a big gap. Do you think it's just a matter that we have more resources at our disposal, or do you think that there's something else at work with regard to that?
Well, part of it's certainly the resources, but the other part of it is that we're the leaders of the free world. And as a leader, you are what your actions say you do. And if you want to continue to be a leader and stand up for our Western values of freedom and justice and a country's right to have a sovereign border, you need to back that up with action. And I believe that United States has I think we've done well by backing up our Ukrainian allies.
Last time you were here, I made mention of the fact that there are some 59 other wars that are taking place in the world at this time. I understand the support of Ukraine. I'm a little bit put off by the fact that there is not proportionate support for some of these other conflicts where people are also fighting for freedom. People are also losing their lives. I'm concerned that we're spending so much time supporting and dollars supporting Ukraine to the neglect of some of these other battles that have been going on a whole lot longer than the battle with Ukraine. And most of them are taking place in nations in Africa and in the Middle East. And, of course, that's black and brown people. And I'm concerned that there does not seem to be the same level of fervor, financial fervor, patriotic fervor, whatever fervor you want to call it, for those battles that are taking place as there is for Ukraine. Your response to that?
Well, I mean, we've certainly spent our fair share of money in the Middle East. That's for sure. I think the number ended up being $6 trillion for the last 20 years in our wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. But, you know, to your point, I do believe it's important that we have leaders who understand the consequences of war. And I think you make a very valid point. And in our United States Senate right now, in our government in general right now, we don't have enough leaders who have firsthand experience with the consequences of war. You know, I've heard such careless things thrown out, like, oh, we should just go to war with this country or that country, or no-fly zone over country X. And it's irresponsible language. Anytime we talk about war, it's never clean, it's never pretty. It's always going to involve sending America's sons and daughters into harm's way. Mm-hmm. And it will always result in the loss of life, both of Americans and our enemy. So I believe we need people like myself who understand those consequences from our firsthand perspective. And right now, we just don't have enough of those in the United States Senate or in Congress in general. I do believe it is time for more people of my generation, those who have been, like, my career exactly matched our time in Afghanistan, like almost to the day. Mm-hmm. And I believe we need more people of my generation who understand how those political decisions have consequences both to our military, to our enemy, and the families of so many American families that have given their sons and daughters for our country.
Let's talk for a minute about the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, I guess, most recent on the, aside from student loan forgiveness. Well, let's talk about student loan forgiveness and the Inflation Reduction Act. Student loan forgiveness, were you in favor of what the president did with regard to student loan forgiveness?
I am in favor of making college more affordable. I just put my daughter through college. I have first, much like we talked about the war in Afghanistan, I have first-hand knowledge on the extravagant expenses of a college education. It is undoable for your middle to low income families. I ask my wife all the time, how are people affording this? It costs so much. But I believe the solution is by making it cheaper for future generations. I think we need to increase the Pell Grant. I think we need to, by increasing the Pell Grant, we could cover up to 70% of the cost for a college education for middle and low income families. I believe we need to provide more grant funding, particularly to our HBCUs, so that we're not nickel and diming these families with every fee that ends up costing, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dollars. But to answer your question with the student loan, I think that it is. I think it's a Band-Aid on the problem, mm-hmm. and doesn't solve the system. As you know, anyone who has a loan, as it came out, anyone after July 1st, it's not going to cover them. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't cover private loans, mm-hmm. and so I don't think it is the permanent solution to the extravagant cost of a college education.
Something I heard this morning that took me a little bit by surprise. Somebody pulled out an old film clip from about a year ago where Speaker Nancy Pelosi made the statement that the president doesn't have the authority to reduce student loan debt. I would imagine that somebody would have discussed that with him before he made this pronouncement, but are you aware of the concerns that what the president did may not be completely kosher with the law?
Well, I'm not sure about the answer to that question. It is obviously a federal student loan forgiveness program.
Right.
And as a president, to the best of my knowledge, he has the authority to do that. But I will come back to one point about the student loan forgiveness. You know, the program we have right now, the federal student loan forgiveness program, I will say that I do support providing loan forgiveness for those professions which serve as a public service or frontline worker, such as a teacher.
Right.
Or a doctor who works in a rural community. I think those are good. They're good investments for our community. I just don't support it as a general blanket for all student loan. But generally speaking, like I said, we just need to make college more affordable so more of our young people can attend without having to get these extravagant student loans in the first place.
Yeah, I was just taken aback by this clip that said that, well, that had the Democratic speaker saying that the president can't do what ultimately the president has done. And I wonder what kind of backlash there's going to be because of that. And there are some, you described yourself as a moderate Democrat. There's some moderate Democrats who are running for office at this time that are not entirely enthusiastic about what the president has done. So I was just interested in your level of enthusiasm about it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to repeat myself a little bit, I just want to solve the problem. And I think it's just putting a Band-Aid on it. And I want to make it easier for future generations to attend college. I say it all the time that, you know, kids, I got to live my wildest dreams. All I wanted to be when a kid, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. It's mm-hmm. all I wanted to do. And I worked hard, but I also had opportunities given to me. I'll fully acknowledge that. Like, I had opportunities. I had I went to public high school. But I had the support system that encouraged me to follow my dreams. And I talk to young kids all the time. We talked about my nieces and my nephews like you. And, you know, no young kids want to live a life of crime.
Mm-hmm.
No young kids want to live in poverty. They want to be pastors like yourself or mm-hmm. pilots like me or film producers or astronauts or doctors and lawyers. And I believe we have a system, particularly here in Louisiana, because our education system is so poor that kids simply don't have the opportunity to follow their dreams. And I'm all about ensuring that our most vulnerable, those who don't always have an equal opportunity. I say everyone has an opportunity, but I do not believe that everyone has an equal opportunity to achieve success in this world. And I want to improve education. I want to invest in early childhood education, invest in our public schools, and invest in our HBCUs so that every kid, whatever you want to be in life, a pastor, a fighter pilot, you can accomplish that dream and have a pathway to a successful future.
Since the last time we talked, the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade and said that there is no constitutional right to an abortion, which has resulted in several states across the nation outlawing mm-hmm. abortion. I think I recall your attitude about mm-hmm. abortion. What's your attitude about the trigger laws that have come up across the nation, including the one here in Louisiana?
Well, as far as the trigger laws and the ones here in Louisiana, they're too extreme. They're simply too extreme. And I believe last month here, I gave you my personal views on it.
Right.
I've described myself as pro-life, with
yes.
strong support for acceptance. And I'm always reminded, you know, who's not pro-life, right? Everyone, mm-hmm. at the core of the word, everyone supports life. But what we're seeing here in Louisiana and other states is simply too extreme. I do not believe that the victim of rape should have to bear their assailant's child. There's nothing pro-life about that to me. You probably read, I don't know if you read in the paper this weekend in The Advocate, about a young mom who is pregnant with a child that does not possess a skull.
Yes.
The child cannot survive.
Yes.
And she will not be provided health care because her life is not in jeopardy. There's nothing pro-life to me about that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the laws like the ones here in Louisiana are too extreme. And I'll be honest with you. I struggled with it. After the Dobbs decision was issued and Roe was overturned, I struggled. And a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of conversations with doctors and lawyers, a lot of conversations with the women in my family and the women all over the state, searching for a solution. How do we solve this problem in this new reality, in this post-Roe reality? How do we solve this? And the answer became very clear to me, is that we need to codify Roe and put it back the way it was before. Because I don't want my nieces or my daughter or my wife to live in a state or a world in which, if they were to become pregnant as a result of rape, that they would be forced to bear that child.
I could not agree with you more. And I
I'm did you struggle as well to, with it?
No, I didn't struggle with it at all.
Yeah.
Years ago, when I was much younger, Bill Clinton made a statement that I thought was right on target. Safe legal and rare. And I think that that's the way it should be. I too consider myself to be pro-life, but I don't feel like the way to promote a pro-life agenda is to deny people access to safe medical care should they choose to do so. So we've had the same position for a long period of time, and so I'm gratified to hear you say that, and hopefully that will happen. Sticking with the Supreme Court for a second, there has been talk, and I don't think it's much more than just talk at this point, about expanding the Supreme Court away from its 9 to a larger number, 13 or 15 or something like that. As a senator, you would certainly have input on such an expansion should it get to the debate stage. Do you have an opinion about Supreme Court expansion?
Well, much like my other comment earlier about, you know, temporary solutions, I believe that that would set a dangerous precedent. You know, if one administration expanded it by 4 to get what they wanted, it would only – the next administration would increase it by another 4 to get what they wanted. So I believe that by expanding the court, we potentially turn them into what is – already turning a little bit into a political institution as opposed to an impartial justice system, that we would just turn it into a political arm of the government, which it should not be. So so I believe we should keep the Supreme Court at the number it is now. But I also think it's important that we have United States senators who are going to confirm Supreme Court nominees and do so in a just way. And I would confirm Supreme Court nominees based upon the totality of their experience and their interpretation of the Constitution, but mostly their defense of our American democracy. And I can say this, I absolutely would have been very proud to support the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Which was on the table the last time we talked, so that was great.
Yes, yeah, that's great.
There have also been discussions about term limits for Supreme Court justices. I believe the number I heard was 18 years at a max for Supreme Court justices. Is that also a Band-Aid, in your opinion?
No, I think I'd be open-minded to that. I would be open-minded to that. I've heard 16 or 18. I think I'm going to do some math in public here, but if you did every – there's 9 of them every 18 years, every – 18, that's 2, right? Every 2 years
you have,
you'd be, so every president would nominate 2 Supreme Court justices. And I'd definitely be open to that. I think there's definitely something there, and I'd be more than happy to consider that. But yeah, for sure.
Can we talk about redistricting? It doesn't affect you in this current race, but it certainly affects the state of Louisiana. From my perspective, we went 0-for-4. In redistricting. We lost on the congressional side. We lost with the state legislature. We lost with our local metro council, and we lost with our local school board. And I know you want to represent the state. I'm speaking personally about here in this area. We're 0-for-4. All of them are going to end up in the federal court system. Probably before the Supreme Court, which at this point doesn't make me feel gleeful about what the outcome is going to be. But it has become such a tribal process that goes against simple logic and fairness. Let's take congressional districts for one example. If we're 1/3 of the state's population and we have 6 congressional seats allotted to this state, it only seems reasonable, mathematical, that there be 2 majority-minority districts, or minority-majority districts, however you say that. But Our state legislature did not see fit to do that. And our governor chose not to, well, he tried to override it, but it didn't, it proved to be unsuccessful. And the courts have said, it's been taken to courts, courts have said, well, it's too close to the election, so we'll put it off until after the election, which means that under the current rules, you're going to have what you have always had, which to me seems unfair. With regard to the state legislature, the governor decided not to even approach that, which said to me that he didn't want his veto to be overturned because he knew that he didn't have the votes. With regard to the school board and the Metro Council, I was in the room when both of those decisions were made, and it was just a bully tactic on the part of the majority to do. They sat there and let people talk and appeal, and with almost no discussion or debate at all, they just did what they wanted to do, feeling like they have the advantage. It's frustrating. I'm doing a podcast tomorrow with Ashley Shelton from Power Coalition, and I'm going to ask her the same question, because Power Coalition pushes hard, telling people to vote, go out and vote, make your voice heard, vote, 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 vote. But if you are gerrymandered into a district in such a way that your vote is nullified, then why are we telling people to go out and vote as if their vote really can make a difference? Again, I know that doesn't apply to you. Yours is a statewide office, so every vote counts. But telling me to go vote in a state legislative district where I'm only 10% of the electorate, it seems fairy tale. To do that. What can be done to fix this redistricting mess that seems to happen and becomes worse every 10 years?
We'll have to rename this hour A Pastor and a Pilot Do Math Together. You're right, right? I mean, six districts, 33% African-American.
Yes.
That's two. That's still two, right? One-third of six, we're still getting the two.
And the way my math works,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's un-American. It's disgusting. We know the results of the elections before they ever take place because they're shaped in a way that there's no competition. LA-2 is a perfect example. It is a gerrymandered district to pack a bunch of Democratic votes, and it's mostly African-Americans, into one district so that their vote more or less is watered down.
Yes.
Let me summarize. We have to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, right? We have to do that, and in order to fix these problems, voters should choose their elected representatives, not the other way around. I believe we should have two congressional districts that are represented by minorities in Louisiana. That's only fair. You're right. It does not affect my election, but it affects me. It affects me as an American citizen, as a Louisiana resident, as someone who loves this country. A lot of time we talk about voting rights, and we talk about whether it be voter ID or access to the ballot or voting on Sundays. And those things are all important, but nothing is as important as gerrymandering we're seeing, because that completely disenfranchises voters. And like you said, it takes all enthusiasm for voting because you already know the results. So I would certainly vote for the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and be a proud advocate of that.
You need 60 votes in the United States. Would you be in favor of getting rid of the filibuster?
I would. For the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, I would support a carve-out for that. Ending the filibuster altogether scares me. It's a double-edged sword, right? If it were not for the filibuster, we very likely would have lost the Affordable Care Act. I also fear that if we ended the filibuster, a lot of these radical laws regarding abortion, like you're seeing in Louisiana, I worry that if we ended the filibuster, and God forbid, but worst case scenario, the Republicans took control of the Senate, I worry that they would make federal legislation that reflected the legislation we had in here in Louisiana, and you'd see a nationwide ban on abortion, and that scares me. So because of my risk tolerance, I suppose, I do not support a complete termination of the filibuster because I fear that Republicans got control of the Senate. I fear what they would do with it. I'm always reminded, you know, when people tell you they are, believe them. And the Affordable Care Act, you know, it's all about being pro-life. The Affordable Care Act has saved lives in this state.
Yes.
And thank God we have Governor John Bel Edwards who expanded Medicaid and ensured that our most vulnerable had quality health care, particularly during COVID. And it really scares. Senator Kennedy has already proven twice now that he'll vote to end the Affordable Care Act. And should we terminate the filibuster, I fear that we would lose the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. I think that's a fair answer. I asked you about student loan forgiveness. I also wanted to ask you about the Inflation Reduction Act. Got away from that. Were you in favor of the Inflation Reduction Act?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's not I think. I know what it does for prescription drug prices. It lowers the premiums on the Affordable Care Act, which we just talked about, is great. But also, I love what it does for our investment in renewable energy and clean energy. I always say Louisiana has to view this transition to renewable energy as an opportunity, not as a burden. And it incentivizes both corporations and individuals to invest in renewable energy. And I think there's going to be a really bright future here in our state. You know, we have the infrastructure. We have the unique workforce. We have the pipelines to be not only an oil and gas state, but be an energy state. And I believe this transition is going to bring, whether it be through wind or solar, is going to bring quality, high-paying jobs. So that all these kids I talk to throughout the state who are leaving to go wherever, to go to other part of the United States or better opportunities, I believe that they'll stay here. And we can keep our best and brightest right here at home. And it's going to not only bring high-quality jobs, it's going to do something about the climate and also secure America's energy independence as well.
I was surprised. We do a weekly staying in prayer segment, and yesterday's topic was the Inflation Reduction Act. I was surprised in doing my research that even Louisiana oil and gas representatives, lobbyists, found something to be happy about in this legislation, because in order to get to renewable energy, there had to be a commitment to traditional mm-hmm. oil and gas energy, and they saw that as a win,
right.
a necessary compromise on this legislation. So it's a rare thing indeed when oil and gas representatives and lobbyists can say, yeah, the Democratic president did something pretty good this time.
Well, not only that, it did increase oil and gas leases on public lands, which is good. We will continue to have oil and gas. Mm-hmm. We need it, right? We need it to feed into or to fuel our country. But look, the biggest investors in renewable energy in Louisiana are ExxonMobil, Shell, and Chevron. Mm-hmm. They are not calling themselves oil and gas companies. They are calling themselves energy companies. And the state of Louisiana cannot be more pro-oil and gas than the oil and gas companies. Mm-hmm. They're transitioning. Let's just make sure we transition with them to build a bright future for our state.
The other day, yesterday, our Metro Council decided to criminalize homelessness. Were you aware of that? The proposal was brought before the Metro Council a couple weeks ago, and it was voted on yesterday to bar tents from being put up on public lands within East Baton Rouge Parish. And it held out the possibility of sanctioning those who continue to do so. You're criminalizing homelessness. And again, you're running for Senate, not running for Metro Council. But I feel like you have to have an opinion about the homeless issue and whether or not that's the appropriate approach to dealing with homelessness. It was voted upon 7-5, Republican 7, Democrat 5. White conservatives, all 7, voted in favor. Black progressives, I think would be fair to say all of them are, voted opposed. So even though you can look at it as a Republican-Democrat issue, it's much more than that, the way that it was handled in this Metro Council. You're a moderate by your own definition. Do you think that that's the right approach to dealing with homelessness?
I'll go back to what I said about kids not wanting to grow up to be criminals. Do we think anyone wants to be homeless?
No, I don't.
I don't think anyone desires that life for themselves. I'm sure every homeless person has a different reason and different story. Probably a lot of heartbreak of why they ended up where they are. And so while I don't know the details of the decision you're speaking of, just from a person that possesses sympathy and empathy for others, the idea of criminalizing someone who is in certainly a difficult, if not impossible, point in their life by making things more difficult for them is, I think you said it best, that's not a political position of mine. That's a Christian position of mine.
Yeah.
I don't think those people should be criminalized. Maybe a better idea is to try and help them out a little bit.
I would think so. I was just curious as to what you thought. Let me turn the page a little bit.
Yes, sir.
I had Mr. Brian Belzer here a couple of weeks ago, who is a candidate for Congress running against Mr. Graves. And his main thrust was about traffic in this area.
There's traffic in this area? What are you talking about?
So he has we disagreed on a whole lot of stuff.
Sure.
But when it came to traffic,
oh, yeah,
we were on the same page.
Uh-huh.
And he knows traffic. He knows every highway out there, what needs to be done.
Whoa.
Is there something that you hope to be able to accomplish with the guy? And I know that Senator
Cassidy?
Cassidy. I don't know why I couldn't think of Bill's first name, last name. I know Senator Cassidy is out there promoting this infrastructure bill. Is there more that can be done to help with traffic concerns in Baton Rouge? Infrastructure in Baton Rouge in particular has not kept pace with the growth in this area. I used to live in New Orleans, and I have watched the infrastructure change dramatically over the past 25, 30 years in New Orleans. How come we can do so much in New Orleans but can't seem to do a whole lot here in Baton Rouge with regard to traffic concerns?
If I had the answer to that, I'd be a wealthy man. If I had the answer to traffic in Baton Rouge, I would wonder how much time I've spent on Mississippi River Bridge in my life. I grew up in central Louisiana,
yeah,
driving. I would like to know how much time I've spent on top of the Mississippi River Bridge, watching the tugboats go underneath me. But look, it all comes down to resources, I believe. If you don't have the resources necessary to expand roads, improve roads, build new bridges, then you're going to have the same results. I'll say this about any problem in life. If something's not working, stop doing it. Regardless of your political philosophy, regardless of your economic philosophy, if it doesn't work, stop it. What we're doing in Baton Rouge obviously does not work. Let's try something different. And I certainly applaud Senator Cassidy for voting for the infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. It's going to provide the resources to improve our roads and to expand. They're talking about we've already expanded I-10. We need to expand I-12. Additionally, that's a mess going I-12. And then certainly I am optimistic about the new Mississippi. I think we talked about this last time, you and I, whether or not
it's 58 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm almost 61. It's 58.
It's 58.
I don't
okay.
know why I'm still calling it the new Mississippi.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
sure don't call myself the new Fred. So, I don't know why we still call it the new Mississippi River Bridge.
I'm optimistic that the new Mississippi River Bridge will alleviate some of these traffic concerns, and I look forward to seeing it, driving over it.
Some of the pushback, I just want to stay with the roads for a little bit longer. Some of the pushback has to do with neighborhoods that will be negatively impacted by the expansion of the interstate, the widening of the interstate. And some of those neighborhoods are traditional, conservative, primarily white neighborhoods. And they seem to have, the residents of those neighborhoods seem to have greater access to the political process and the representatives within that political process than others have. Is there a way to balance that out such that what is in the best interest of the parish as a whole takes precedence over the special interests of people who live in South Downs? That's what I'm talking about, primarily the people who live in South Downs.
Well, look, I'll speak to the larger question, and the larger question being, you know, for so often we've put in these huge projects, whether it's roads or bridges, in quite often poor African American communities because we didn't want them other places because they didn't have the political clout to prevent that from happening. And I think our nation is, you cannot look back on our nation's history and not recognize that we have a sinful past. We have a past that did not provide everyone equal opportunity. We have a past that discriminated against the African American community for centuries. There's no denying that. And frankly, you know, those are the values the value my parents always emphasized to me is the respect and dignity for everyone, giving everyone an equal opportunity. And I mentioned January 6th being a large reason for my candidacy and why I want to do this. But the other reason is that I want to be a part of our continued progress, the continuation of this American dream, which is all about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And I believe everyone has a right to that. I am proud of the progress this country has made. I am proud of the progress that no doubt you have made toward ensuring that we have equal opportunity in this nation. But as I mentioned with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, as you just mentioned, with putting roads in communities that don't have political clout, we're not there. We have not achieved equal opportunity in this nation, and I want to be a part of that continued process, and that's why I'm running for the United States Senate.
Our neighbor to the west, Texas, seems to still have problems with flooding and keeping electrical grids up and running. I guess that too is an infrastructure problem. From your perspective, is Louisiana improving? Because we were predicted to have a very hectic hurricane season. It has not happened yet, thank God. Don't know what the next couple of weeks are going to bring. But there's always the fear that we're one storm away from being without power. Do you see where we're making improvement with regard to our electrical infrastructure?
Oh, we're not anywhere close. You know, I was in New Orleans the other day. We still have the wooden post with the electrical wires overhanging. Like,
yeah,
that needs to be underground.
Yeah,
right. I'm not an electrician, but those wires need to be underground. We need to harden our electrical system to protect us from these violent winds and violent storms. And a wooden post with the wires hanging, forgive me, it ain't gonna work.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and this infrastructure bill. Hopefully, we'll get some dollars for that to harden our electrical system because the storm obviously has awful consequences. But a lot of the deaths occur after the storm when you have the elderly who don't have air conditioning in August in Louisiana. So, I think we need to do more to harden our electrical system to protect us from the aftermath of these dangerous storms.
What final word would you like to leave with our audience? Primarily African American, mostly Christian folk who are watching or listening. What final word would you like to leave with them?
Well, I'll finish with thank you so much for inviting me back. Thank you for letting me participate in your service the other day. My niece and I enjoyed it so much. She's still talking about it. The final word is I am really excited about this campaign. I have lived a life of service to our nation. I want to continue to serve our state. For too long, our state particularly our most vulnerable, which all too often has been the African-American community, has not had an equal shot at this wonderful American dream. And I want to continue in that progress to ensure that every kid gets to live his wildest dreams.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Luke Mixon, for coming by, sharing with us. And hopefully the next time I see you, I'll be saying congratulations, Senator.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you for viewing. Thank you for watching. We'll be back again next time.
Thank you.